This film's part of a new research project I'm looking at the relationship between youth cultures and politics in the 70s and 80s in Britain. And this particular paper will form part of a, hopefully, it's more or less signed and sealed, a special issue of a journal called Contemporary British History, where a few of us are looking at the way in which youth culture and politics fed into the 1970s and the dislocation of what's generally seen as the post-war consensus and the move towards monetarism, Thatcherism and all those kind of things. So that's the kind of background context to it. Okay, I'll start with an anecdote. Let's just picture this, okay? Summer of 1977, Jubilees coming round and all that kind of stuff. It's very hot. The Young Communist League decide to send a letter to the Sex Pistols through the paper of his newspaper, Challenge, it was called, the Young Communist newspaper. They propose that the communists and the punks, whom the Sex Pistols were seen as being the pioneers of, or representing the pioneer of punk, quote, get together, bands, fanzines, followers, to fight for our rights. The letter registered admiration for the Sex Pistols' uncompromising approach and agreed with what it understood to be punk's kind of social economic diagnosis. Quote again, for the kids of Britain today, the situation stinks. So that's how the communists saw punk. The YCL argued that the time was right to coordinate a more effective response to the seemingly limited prospects afforded to young people in a period of rising unemployment and simmering social tensions. As things stood, they suggested, the Sex Pistols had only really fought back through one channel, the music industry. They accused the Pistols of having neglected where their real strength lies, which was on the streets, in the council estates of the inner city areas and new towns, with the kids. And by working together, the Young Communists reasoned, communists and punks could better resist those establishment forces that had served to repress British youth. What about it? They asked in a rather awkward and a kind of un-Leninist fashion. Now, whether the Pistols were ever made aware of the YCL's offer is not known. What is clear is that the YCL was just one of many political organisations with members keen to tap in to the latent rebellion apparently given vent by punk in the mid-1970s. Most visibly, perhaps, the Socialist Workers' Party were integral to the Rock Against Racism campaign that emerged parallel to punk, combining to organise a series of carnivals and gigs with the Anti-Nazi League and to mobilise young people in opposition to the far-right National Front. For some in the SWP, punk was a healthy expression of young working-class anger, born from the iniquities of capitalism. So a quote by a chap called Roger Huddle, who wrote for one of the party's publications, said, living in crumbling cities, bored and broke, can make you pretty vacant and violent. Punk expresses that. Similarly, the Labour Party Young Socialists, which by this time were kind of dominated by Trotskyists based around the Militant newspaper, resolved in early 1978 to approve punk's anti-establishment stance and to acknowledge it as a projection of genuine working-class frustration. And the International Marxist Group, best known for Tariq Ali, claimed members who saw in punk, quote, a tendency towards a primitive socialist protest that was rooted in the white working class and reflective of Britain in capitalist crisis. So there's this whole kind of series of people within the far left, the revolutionary left, who see punk as a signal that things are happening, revolution's brewing. Now this didn't go unchallenged, as we'll see in a little bit, and nor was it just those on the left who recognised punk as giving off signals of a politicised youth movement. Members of the National Front and the Nazi British movement also claimed punk as a signal towards their own brand of revolution. Given this, punk as a musical form and as a wider youth culture became a contested site of political engagement in the late 1970s and early 1970s. It was fought over by organisations on the left and the right. And alongside debates as to punk's political meaning, punk bands regularly played benefit gigs for causes that ranged from Rock Against Racism to the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament to concerts supporting striking workers and prisoners' rights organisations. The last Sex Pistols gig in Britain was for the striking firemen in December 1977. And from the outset, punk used political signifiers, swastikas, images of Marx, the anarchy symbol, to provoke reaction and to evoke the sense of socio-economic crisis that pervaded the British media at the time. And even more dramatically, some punk gigs were often disrupted by competing political factions. Sham 69, a punk group formed in 1977, their concerts became a rallying point for British movement and National Front supporters in the late 1970s. While the leftist allegiances of some bands, such as the Gang of Four, the name gives it away a bit, ensure that their gigs regularly succumbed to outbreaks of political violence. The anarchist band Crass, as well, who took the anarchy symbol of punk very seriously, found themselves playing host to confrontations between activists of the far left and the far right. Now, this interplay between politics, popular music and youth culture, I think, raises a number of interesting questions, especially when placed in the context of the severe economic and political dislocations of the time. Punk, by late 1976, kind of was named in the mid to late 1976, was seen to reflect a breakdown in the post-war consensus. It was typically portrayed as a product of crisis that in its music, its rhetoric, its attitude and its style seemed to embody Britain's deteriorating economic and moral standing. And so for Caroline Coon, who was one of the music journalists who first wrote about punk in the music press, she said it was only natural that a group of deprived London street kids, such as the Pistols, would produce music with a startlingly anti-establishment bias. And similarly, punk's detractors in the mainstream media recognised within it a reaction to unemployment, to poor education, to failed urban planning. The kind of editorials of the Daily Mirror, the Mail, the Sun, etc., often related punk to these kind of social contemporary problems. But I suppose what I wanted to ask is, to what extent did punk and its various cultural offshoots represent either a genuine or a conscious form of cultural revolt? And this leads back to research that was really pioneered in the 1960s into the 1970s by the Birmingham University Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies. People like Stuart Hall is perhaps one of the most famous advocates of this. And they suggested that aspects of youth culture can be read as sites of resistance to pervading or prevailing social economic structures, class relations and cultural hegemony. Punk may have been quickly codified and commodified over the course of 1977, but did the initial resentments and challenges offered by bands like the Sex Pistols and the Clash represent a politicised youth culture that continued to have a resonance after the kind of the media clamour had died down at the end of 1977? And if so, what exactly was punk revolting against? In what ways and to what end? So what I'm going to do in this article and paper is to examine the issues, an issue that kind of relates closely to this. And this is the way in which political organisations of the far right and far left try to project their own politics onto punk, and the way in which punk then responded to that. So the first section I'll look at the way in which the left tried to understand punk and claim it as a kind of signal for a revolutionary socialist politics. Now, the socialist left in Britain in the late 1970s and early 1980s can be described, I think, as vibrant but fractious. On the one hand, capitalism appeared to be in crisis. Inflationary pressures inherited from the 1960s had led to a rise in unemployment and industrial conflict that combined to inaugurate a prolonged period of social, economic and political unrest. Such tensions were exacerbated by the 1973 oil crisis, which led eventually to James Callaghan's Labour government abandoning its commitment to Keynesian economics and appealing to the International Monetary Fund in an attempt to secure the pound. Come the winter of 1978-79, of course, and a further wave of industrial unrest served as a prelude to a recession that saw Margaret Thatcher's first Conservative government preside over record levels of unemployment and a spate of inner-city riots, born in large part from socio-economic and racial tensions that had long simmered across the UK. Britain, as one contemporary writer put it in 1978, appeared to be in agony. It was at war on the picket lines, scarred by mainland IRA bombings, and on certain inner city streets, confronted by a buoyant National Front keen to foment racial violence. Not surprisingly, the British left tended to interpret such events as the convulsions of a fading imperialist power, struggling to cope with a global capitalist crisis. The so-called consensus it seemed, was beginning to crumble. On the other hand, the left was fragmented and, for the most part, detached from the wider British Labour movement. There were a number of leftist groups, the largest of which remained the Communist Party of Great Britain. But there also existed a number of other organisations and kind of tendencies that had emerged out of really the emergence of the new left from 1956 and the dwindling appeal of the Soviet model as a revolutionary exemplar. There were numerous subsects and cross-party groupings, new social movements, Maoists, anarchists, all forming and splintering across the left. And all of these groups were numerically small. None could boast either the working class credentials of the Labour Party or indeed even the diminishing Communist Party. And had their main kind of centres of support often really on kind of university campuses amongst kind of students and within the sections of the professional classes. And this in turn in some ways allowed for new sources of inspiration to compete with Marx, Lenin, Stalin and Trotsky as guides to revolution. So where Ho Chi Minh and Che Guevara were the kind of poster boys for the 1960s student protests, so the likes of Althusser, Barthes, Benjamin, Gramsci, Mao, Marcuse began to shape the intellectual discussions of Britain's leftist milieu in the 1970s. New sites of struggle were being demarcated. It wasn't just about the workplace anymore. Culture, language, youth, race, gender, sexuality and the media all became terrains of engagement. The personal became political. And it was in just such a context that punk came onto the radar of Britain's leftist organisations in late 1976. The Communist Party had for some time been engaged in a debate as to whether youth cultures were simply the commercialised products of capitalism or, as the party's Martin Jacks suggested, a formative side of the class struggle. For Paul Bradshaw, who was the editor of the YCL's Challenge magazine in 1976, youth cultural styles and popular music were mediums that could sometimes embody rebellion. Punk, therefore, emerged to meet Jacks and Bradshaw's brief with a kind of perfect synchronicity. Here, it seemed to Bradshaw, was a youth movement that comprised, quote, working class kids to the core, tired of having no voice to shout about unemployment and the other rubbish we're being fed. And for this reason, the Young Communist League lends its support to punk from the beginning of 1977. The newspapers of the Young Communist League begin to replicate punk fanzines, their kind of cut and paste design, very similar to the kind of punk magazines of the time. And they provide space to review punk records and interview punk bands. And a similar response was also evident within the Socialist Workers' Party, the SWP. Although the party leadership retains its primary focus on industrial protest, the SWP's largely non-proletarian composition and emphasis on rank-and-file organisation ensured that it developed links to grassroots struggles beyond the organised labour movement. This became very evident in its mobilising local and nationwide resistance to the National Front in the mid-1970s, and also with regard to the unemployed, particularly the young unemployed and the Right to Work campaign. And so within its ranks, it included people like David Widgery and Roger Huddle, who were both co-founders with others of Rock Against Racism, who understood popular culture as a medium through which people could, quote, find their pleasure, entertainment and celebration alongside their sexual identity, their political courage and their strength to change. And so punk was read as a cultural response to ongoing social economic changes and crises that engendered industrial protests and exacerbated tensions in Britain. In the words of Gary Bushell, who at this time was a member of the SWP, not the columnist for the Sun that he later becomes, but was a Marxist or Trotskyist, he was writing for the Socialist Worker in December 1976, and he suggested that punk's aggressive aggression reflected the anger of a generation who graduated from school only to serve their time on street corners and on the dole. It was working class rebellion, he argued, a violent reaction to a society collapsing around it. And what the SWP needed to do, Bushell argued, was to channel it into a real revolutionary movement. Now, the revolutionary potential that some on the left perceived in punk took a variety of forms. First, as should be clear, it was recognised as an expression of working class revolt. Now, the shortcomings of too overt a class reading of punk have long been demonstrated by social commentators, journalists and historians. Nevertheless, punk's urbanity and its rhetoric of rebellion lent it an oppositional edge that was often expressed in social economic terms. There was, moreover, a significant strand of punk that proudly proclaimed its working class identity, leading to certain bands such as the Angelic Upstarts, Sham 69, being feted for their supposed honesty and class credibility by the left. Second, the left welcomed and to a notable extent directed punk's commitment to anti-racism. There had initially been some concern that the apparently unfocused nature of punk's anger would eventually drift rightwards towards the National Front and the British movement. Most obviously, punk used the swastika early on as a kind of symbol to shock. And this raised alarm bells that both the bands such as the Pistols and the Clash were somehow right-wing, and they were reprimanded by left-wing student groups in 1976 during their various tours of the country. Songs such as White Riot by the Clash and God Save the Queen by the Pistols were deemed to be potentially reactionary. But for enthusiasts on the left, it became essential to align punk to the anti-racist cause, picking up and propagating anti-racist comments from the likes of Johnny Rotten, the Sex Pistols lead singer, and Joe Strummer of The Clash, and to cultivate affinities between punk and elements of black youth culture. And so Rock Against Racism quickly organised gigs that presented punk and reggae bands on the same bill, championed punks in its magazine, Temporary Hoarding, one of which is up there, and ensured that punk bands dominated the carnivals organised in association with the Anti-Nazi League. So the Manchester one's got Manchester's premier punk band Buzzcocks at the head of the bill. Thirdly, punk was soon recognised to have created a welcome opportunity for women to form bands and express their opinions. Initially, there'd been some concern that punk had harboured misogynistic tendencies. Certain bands like the Stranglers and some of the early Pistols lyrics were picked up on as being rather misogynistic. But the high profile of women within the early punk fraternity, people like Vivian Westwood, Jordan, who's the person top right there next to Susie Sue from Susie and the Banshees, bands like the Slits, X-Ray Specs, the Raincoats, Au Pairs, Delta 5, Ludus, Poison Girls, there's a number of bands, emerged to challenge the masculine conventions of popular music. Punk, Lynn Hutchinson argued, and again in a Young Communist publication, represented a new attitude in music that women could relate to. It allowed women to contest perceived notions of sexuality and offered a space for women to perform and articulate an overtly feminist viewpoint. Fourthly, punk's rhetoric of autonomy fed into wider debates on the left as to the potential for cultural revolt. How far can culture be used for political ends, particularly within the framework of a capitalist system? For some, the Sex Pistols had instigated a direct challenge to the music industry and the media that sustained it. The band represented a deliberate act of provocation and demystification. Simultaneously, however, the self-financed release of records such as these, like the Buzzcocks' Spiral Scratch EP, Top Right's the first of these, on the band's own label, published and distributed by the band itself, offered an alternative approach for countless bands to disseminate their own music and ideas. And this in many ways replicated what certain Communist Party aligned musicians, like Henry Cow, a kind of avant-garde band at the time, had begun to argue for: a democratisation of music that allowed artists to control the process of production and to circumnavigate the music industry in pursuit of greater freedom of expression. So bands such as the Desperate Bicycles, the top left, Scritti Politti, the lead singer of which was on the editorial board of Challenge, the Young Communist paper, and the Buzzcocks, were deemed as important by many on the left as records by the Sex Pistols and the Clash, more well-known punk records. On the back of some of these records, they detailed the cost of production. They told you where to go to get your records printed, how to make a record. So demystifying the kind of opaque world of the music industry. And in a similar way, the dissemination of punk fanzines was seen as a kind of parallel but similar movement in relation to the media of the time. replacing the music press, basically. And finally, many on the left appreciated and tried to inform punk's willingness to question the lyrical and structural norms of popular music. Punk's disregard for musical proficiency and its claims to realism was seen to break down the barriers that had traditionally separated musicians and their audience. In punk, the audience were encouraged to get involved, to form their own groups, interact with the bands before and after gigs and during gigs, to make films, write fanzines, dress distinctively. By 1978, several groups inspired by punk's spirit of revolt endeavoured to better focus its political point and purpose. Lyrically, issues related to contemporary events, to sexual politics, to the commercialisation of leisure under capital, the tyranny of imperialism had come to the fore in many punk records. In some instances, questions of hegemony and reification, kind of leftist terms of the time, were actually interspersed into songs, into interviews within the music press. Some bands even had members with open political affiliations, such as Green Guards, side of Scritti Politti. As importantly, punk and post-punk bands sought to subvert rock's form, splicing together different musical styles, rejecting traditional song structures, and discarding such recognised clichés as rock and roll guitar solos or on-stage macho posturing. Some of this later becomes known as post-punk, and kind of what punk opened the space for these ideas and experiments with music to take place. And the idea throughout was to challenge the audience's preconceptions while simultaneously dissolving the power structures that divided the performer and the spectator. Now, there were, of course, many on the left who saw punk simply as a passing fad that brought no positive value to the broader struggle for socialism. And just as traditionalists in the Communist Party bemoaned the cultural emphasis of those seeking to reform the party, the kind of cultural turn that was going on at the time, so Tony Cliff of the Socialist Workers' Party was forced to intervene following a conference resolution that objected to the Socialist Worker becoming what the conference decided was a punk paper. They were giving far too much time to these punks and youth cultural activities. They should be looking at what's going on in the workplace and on the picket line. The letters pages of magazines like Challenge, Militant, Socialist Worker and Young Socialist also revealed divergent views as to punk's political meaning. While the Socialist Festival of Music, which was organised by the Communist Party-related Music for Socialism in the summer of 1977, was reportedly dominated by an acrimonious debate as to whether punk was progressive or reactionary. Apparently, whatever they talked about, it kept coming back to the question of punk. Now, this related really to the left's traditional response to popular culture, which had tended to be to dismiss it either as irrelevant or as little more than a product of American cultural imperialism. In more sophisticated terms, the arguments of people like Theodore Adorno, were applied to determine the meaning of popular music against its mode of production. Taken to its extreme, such reasoning could declare punk but another example of pop music served up as, quote, a pacification agent of the young proletariat. So it's an invention of capital to simulate rebellion rather than actually go out and revolt. It's a substitute for the revolutionary becoming of the proletariat. For Julian Leach, who was a member of the Workers' Revolutionary Party in the late 1970s, punk was tailor-made for the interests of capital. It was a breeding ground for fascism, he argued, that served less as a soporific and more as a deliberate plot designed to provide an excuse for the growing police state whose ready target is the revolutionary working class. Not dissimilarly, Maoist musicians of the People's Liberation Music felt able to dismiss punk as fascist simply by looking at that record cover. So because there's a Union Jack on the breast of Paul Simonon over there, because there's police running Notting Hill Carnival there, and because in the bottom right there's a symbol of capitalist imperialism, CBS, that's fascist. There was the Maoist take on punk. But despite such critiques, most leftist commentaries on punk and youth culture rejected their being read as a commercial conspiracy to redirect young people away from the class struggle. And such kind of one-dimensional semiotic readings as the Maoists had about that cover were probably not the norm within the left. Even the Workers' Revolutionary Party softened its line a little bit by mid-1978, inviting bands such as X-Ray Specs to play at its Jobs for Youth events and providing space in its publications for bands such as The Ruts and Sham 69. Rather, the relationship between culture, commerce, consumption and politics was broadly recognised to be a complex and interactive process into which political meaning could be inserted and from which cultural forms could be utilised for progressive or revolutionary ends. The success of Rock Against Racism revived the idea of popular music serving as a medium for mass mobilisation and diverted much of the letter discussion towards the ways by which it could recruit and direct those who were politicised in the wake of punk. For many on the organised left, attention shifted away from the political meanings contained within punk's musical form, process and youth culture, and towards the extent and nature of a band's music or a musician's political comment. This meant that increasingly the left began to become more critical of punk musicians and punk's audience. So while someone like Tom Robinson was applauded for their willingness to align to an array of progressive causes and write suitably kind of conscious lyrics, so many other bands became subject to ideological criticism or deemed unworthy of serious interest. So if the left recognised punk as providing a cultural outlet for dissent, then its apparently temporal nature and the contradictory impulses within it meant that it offered a somewhat unreliable means of propagating socialism. And I'll come back to the ramifications of that in a minute. Okay, the right. Now, the 1970s saw British fascism emerge from its doldrums that it had really laboured under since Mosley's heyday of the 1930s. The principal vehicle for this was the National Front, which formed in 1967, and which grew steadily thereafter as questions of immigration and national identity found their way to the centre of the mainstream political agenda. National Front marches became more frequent and larger in scale as the decade drew on, while its paper sellers became a common sight on street corners, football matches and even outside the school gate in certain inner city areas. And this in turn provoked opposition from local community groups and the left, leading ultimately to instances of violent disorder that ranged from small-scale skirmishes to the large-scale kind of bloody battles of Lewisham in 1977 and Southall in 1979, which is perhaps the two most famous. Now, the National Front's growth related to the mood of crisis that hung over Britain in the 1970s, the loss of empire, entry into Europe, mounting economic problems, all of this ensured that far-right appeals to patriotism and a national revival had a resonance. Immigration provided a simplistic and prejudicial explanation for rising unemployment and related social issues, while the assertive militancy of the trade union movement fanned fears of incipient communism and lent credence to the idea that political power was no longer the preserve of Parliament. In addition, disillusionment with the Labour government and a growing sense by which the non-Labour left was associated with students and the middle-class intellectuals or professionals served to open up a political space for the National Front amongst what had previously been Labour's core working-class vote. Young people in particular became a target for the National Front, leading to the formation of a Young National Front in 1977, members of which are in the bottom right-hand corner. Now, there was competition. As with the left, the far right had a tradition of factionalism that ensured rival organisations formed in and around the National Front slipstream. There was the National Party, which split from the National Front in 1976. There was the more National Socialist British movement. There were smaller groups, such as the League of St. George and Column 88. And after the general election of 1979, the National Front itself splits into four separate organisations: the New National Front, National Front, the British Democratic Party, Constitutional Movement, and then in 1982 there's the British National Party. Now, with regard to youth culture and popular music, the far right's official position was typically conservative. In simple terms, the far right tended to see classic art forms as being associated with classic civilizations. That is, culture was seen to reflect the strength and vitality of a nation or race. So scruffy punks didn't really represent the kind of the new breed of the nation as they so wished. For far-right leaders such as the National Front's John Tyndall, this meant a veneration of non-modernist art forms rooted in European or the British past. Pop music, by contrast, was seen to be alien and a degenerate cultural form that served only to distort Britain's true identity. So in the words of Colin Jordan, the founder of the British movement, rock and pop were, quote, the manifestation of the jungle. It was the musical counterpart to, quote, the Afro-Asian influx that facilitated Britain's national decline. Punks, Jordan said, were freaks who shared nothing with a real and radical racialism. But despite this, there were those on the far right who saw potential in punk's cultural assault. Most immediately, punk's adoption of the swastika, and Vivian Westwood in the top left is wearing one of her designs with the swastika on it, drew predictable attention. In the early 1977, the British Patriot, which was the journal of the British movement, carried an anonymous article suggesting that, quote, with the now notorious cropped-haired punk rockers making the headlines, dressed as they are with iron crosses and swastikas on their armbands, the hippies and the long hairs of yesteryear are fighting a rearguard scuttle. Punk, it was said in this article, was a sign of white youngsters becoming aware of their own identity, going so far as to say pubs that played punk were effectively issuing a discreet colour bar. Newspapers too reported that the National Front had been alerted by punk's use of Nazi symbolism and were beginning to recruit from amongst punk audiences. And according to Mark Perry, who was the editor of the first punk fanzine, Sniffing Glue, the NF invited him along to one of their meetings. He didn't go. Not dissimilarly, John Street, who's a professor of politics at the UEA, in his book Rebel Rock, noted that the far right picked up on aspects, language and imagery to reinforce or kind of signpost opinions already held within the racialist milieu. Now, this was very superficial. It basically meant any song title that had white in the title, or a picture of the Union Jack on its sleeve, or talked about issues of race or nation or violence or fascism or anti-communism, were picked up and mentioned within far-right publications. So even anti-fascist bands could be included in the pages of the Young National Front's Bulldog magazine. So bands like The Clash, because they had a song called White Riot, were put in the charts of the Young National Front. Even bands with mixed racial composition, like The Specials, could find their way into the charts of the National Front. The very fact that punk engaged with such issues as class, national identity, racial tension, state oppression and street-level violence ensured that it shared common interests with members and potential members of Britain's far right. Punk's fascination with history, with the aesthetics and iconography of fascism, with some punk-related sleeves, which are the record at the bottom is the SS Records, the others, the symbolism, were often ambiguous enough for tendentious claims to be made. And because of this, some on the far right saw in punk's disaffection rejection of formal politics that opened a way to recruitment. As noted above, the National Front and the British movement had begun to focus its attention on working class youth by the mid-1970s, propagating the far right message at football matches and towards those looking for, quote, an alternative to the humdrum life of liberal society, unquote. With punk, which seemed to politicise popular music, so a further point of contact emerged. Punk's aggression, its rebelliousness, its claims to working class authenticity appealed to just those that the National Front and the British movement wished to mobilise. So the chap in the bottom right there with the white t-shirt on, Zeke Hiley, that's a bloke called Chris Chubby Henderson, who'd already spent much of his youth scrapping in and around the terraces of Stamford Bridge. And for him, punk provided the perfect soundtrack to his politics and lifestyle. In his memoirs, which are not a great read, I have to say, but in his memoirs he talked about, quote, the lads fought on a Saturday afternoon and the new punk band sung about it later in their raw, unrefined lyrics. He talked about how now the boys would smash up a pub to the sound of The Clash or Generation X instead of the Four Tops. And as a result, people like Henderson and others active on the far right began to adopt certain punk bands as their own, used to follow them around London and cause trouble wherever they went, bringing their politics with them and rejecting leftist attempts to channel punk's revolt towards more progressive ends. And the presence of young right-wing activists at punk gigs soon encouraged National Front and British movement organisers to forge more substantial links to youth culture. Racist and nationalist interventions at gigs were regularly reported in Bulldog, while members were encouraged to write to the music press and distribute racist literature inside and outside gigs. In Leeds, a chap called Eddie Morrison launched a punk front fanzine in 1978, and developed what was called Rock Against Communism, which was a far-right alternative to Rock Against Racism. For years, Joe Pearce of the Young National Front wrote in 1979, "White British youths have had to put up with left-wing filth in rock music. They have had to put up with anti-NF lies in the music press. They've had commie organisations like Rock Against Racism trying to brainwash them. But now there is an anti-commie backlash." And such a backlash proved initially, at least, to be very limited. Only a handful of very minor punk bands associated themselves with Rock Against Communism. Its inaugural concert was held in 1979 in London's Conway Hall and attracted between 150 and 300 people. But the re-emergence of a band called Screwdriver, who were an early punk band from Blackpool, reinvigorated Rock Against Communism in the early 1980s and paved the way for White Noise Records and what was called kind of white power music that became disseminated worldwide through the Blood and Honour franchise, which was developed by the far right in the 1980s. The far right also sought to tap into various subculture revivals that had mutated out of punk in the later 1970s. Most obviously, both the British movement and the National Front recruited from among the young skinheads who re-emerged around mid-1977. Oi! Example of an Oi band in the left there, the Foreskins. Oi was a hard-edged punk style defined by its working-class rhetoric and links to the skinhead culture. It was recognised by Bulldog as the music of the ghetto. Its energy expresses the frustrations of white youths. Its lyrics describe the reality of life in the dole. It's about fighting the government, fighting the whole system. It's the music of white rebellion. Now, in fact, the primary focus of Oi centred around the experience of being a young working-class male, predominantly. And bands such as Sham 69, Cockney Redex, the Foreskins and others sang of football violence, youth culture, petty crime, unemployment and police harassment. But always oft repeated references to class identity, social inequality, combined with its unabashed patriotism and suspicion of middle class socialism, ensured that it won plaudits from the far right just as easily as it won criticism from the left. Similarly, two-tone bands that emerged out of punk, top left, there's the Specials. Certain bands, particularly Madness and Bad Manners in London, found their gigs home to significant numbers of young British movement and National Front members. Indeed, two-tone's amalgam of punk and ska provided a connecting point between the skinhead culture past and present, a heady brew that often manifested itself in violent confrontation between those who recognised the cross-cultural lineage of two-tone and the original skinhead movement of the late 1960s, and those keen to make connections to a more racially distinct form of politics. Despite such efforts, far-right attempts to use punk as a means of validating or reinforcing a set of racist or nationalistic political values proved of limited effect. Not only were very few bands willing to align themselves with organisations located on the far-right, but the connections that were made between punk and either fascism or extreme nationalism were largely superficial. A handful of members of bands relating to punk, Oi and Two Tone had members or associates that had far-right pasts and evidently formed part of a kind of social milieu from which the National Front and the British movement had connections. But more generally, it may be argued that the far-right came to see punk and its related offshoots as providing more of a site rather than a medium for political engagement. They sought to lay claim to the spaces in which youth were gathering, at gigs in the streets or the shops. They kind of colonised them, I suppose. So the politics of the British movement and National Front competed with, and often were eclipsed by, more pertinent concerns of male youth, such as football rivalries, cultural style and local affinity. But even if far-right politics helped inform the identity of some of them punk and skinhead culture, then the vast majority resisted and rejected the substance a fascist message. White power music may have had its roots in punk, but bands like Screwdriver were very much the runt of a far more diverse and complex litter. So what I want to do in the final bit is look at the way in which punk then responded to the overtures from the far left and the far right. There's no doubt that the far left and far right fed into and helped inform British punk. A lot of the subject matter that punk dealt with was a subject matter that was ongoing in leftist and rightist conversations. Fascism seemed to be a constant source of fascination within punk, both as a warning from history that seemed to chime with the times of the 1970s, but also the ultimate taboo, to which the slightest reference passed as an act of transgression. Yet the relationship between organised political groupings and punk was fraught with multiple tensions. Punk, be it defined as a musical, stylistic, or in commodified terms, proved too diverse and incoherent a cultural form to be harnessed by any distinct political ideology. Punk resonated because it captured a mood. It gave vent to frustrations of both social, economic, and existential origin at the precise moment when Britain itself was passing through a period of crisis, uncertainty, and change. Of course, punk's appeal stemmed almost also from its being visually and orally exciting, not to mention it was willfully puerile at times. But its real power was born from the kind of friction, the clashing of signifiers and symbols that was ongoing within punk. Its fusion of cultural innovation and popularism, of collective individualism and creative negation. Now, punk did have certain political roots. As is well known, Malcolm McLaren, the manager of the Sex Pistols, Jamie Reid, who designed the Sex Pistols' imagery, were heavily influenced by the ideas and approach of radical political groups such as the Situationists and early British anarchist groups like King Mob. Their subsequent use of political symbols and slogans, not to mention the Sex Pistols' statement of intent, anarchy in the UK, deliberately invited a politicised reading of the band's actions and purpose. But if punk was inherently political in that it critically engaged with the world of which it was part and served as a means to express anger and opinion, then it tended to resist being aligned either politically or ideologically. So, for example, Johnny Rotten could state categorically that he found National Front politics ridiculous and inhumane, but that did not thereby translate into support for the revolutionary or socialist left, who Rotten criticised for being, quote, too separated from reality, and whose approach to working people, again, quote, comes across as condescending in its attitude and is not appreciated. The Clash, too, would often receive telegrams of congratulations from the SWP for their stance on things like on racism, and were asked to come and join the SWP in various kind of ways. But Joe Strummer criticised the SWP's approach as being dogma, and said he had wanted nothing to do with such ideological, dogmatic ideas. So punk, I'd suggest, began to articulate a kind of politicised anti-politics. This, Mark Perry of the Sniffing Glue fanzine said, related to a suspicion of organisations and a sense by which the ideologies of both the left and the right served only to negate the individual. Punk was about thinking and doing things for yourself, Perry argued, not what people told you to do. Slightly more intellectually, Howard Devoto, the lead singer and lyricist, first of all for Buzzcocks and then for Magazine, he retained a kind of existential disregard for ideological and political certainties that led to a socialist friend of the time to comment that when the barricades go up, you'll be shot by both sides, hence the title of the paper. In the song of the same name, Devoto celebrated the non-aligned individual, who is lost in the crowd and somehow exists outside of everything. But punk's rejection of organised politics also drew from a more intuitive disregard for institutions and authority. According to members of both the Angelic Upstarts and the Ruts, two very kind of working class punk bands, their politics and their support for Rock Against Racism was based on principle and a gut reaction. It did not mean that either band subscribed to a political label. So the Ruts' Malcolm Owen said, "None of us are socialist workers, we just don't like racists." As I suggest, many punk and later two-tone, oi bands and post-punk bands were willing to declare their opposition to racism and the politics of the National Front, but remained suspicious of the motivations and objectives of leftist groups seeking to channel such protests into more formal support. This was occasionally borne out of confusion. So Jimmy Percy, chap on the bottom right, second one in from the right there, the lead singer of Sham 69, he struggled to cope with the demands made of him by both his audience, which was beginning to include a kind of far-right element, and by the political organisations that staged or frequented his gigs. He was asked to perform at a Rock Against Racism gig to kind of disassociate himself from the far right. Percy knew little about political ideologies neither left or right that competed to claim his band as their own. His politics were based primarily on uniting working class kids to vent their frustrations at various establishment forces. As a result, Percy turned up at events organised by just about every acronym on the left, while also trying to harness the influence of a significant right-wing element in his audience. The result, not surprisingly, was criticism from the left for not doing more to expel rightist elements, and from the right for lending support to Rock Against Racism and appearing at leftist gigs. And so the story goes, Percy received a death threat for appearing at the Rock Against Racism Carnival in April 1978, and following on from which, outbreaks of violence at the band's gigs, particularly in London, led him to propose a gig strike by punk bands, which didn't happen, but also ultimately for him to refuse to play live again after the famous Shams Last Stand in July 1979, where the British movement shut down the gig. A more rounded critique of the political left and right was proposed by Crass, top right. Now, Crass brought to punk an agenda and a worldview informed by a radical politics that predated and transcended the supposed year zero of 1976. They adopted anarchy not simply as a provocative symbol of personal self-determination, but as the basis for an alternative society capable of sustaining itself outside of the mainstream. They took punk's anarchy seriously. The band lived collectively, refused all cooperation with the music industry, printed and distributed numerous incendiary pamphlets, and lent their support to a range of radical causes. The band's defining statement insisted that there is no authority but yourself, a position that fed into a far broader analysis of the various systems, ideologies, and institutions that maintained political and socioeconomic power. For Crass and for associated bands, both the right and left-wing states employ force to maintain power. People are reduced to simple tools servicing the machinery of the state, and as such are expected to live and, if needs be, die for the state. So they objected equally to the left and the right of being statist ideologies. So they rejected the power politics, as they called it, of the CPGB and the SWP, as well as those of the National Front and the BN. They even went so far as to denounce Rock Against Racism for trying to claim punk for the organised left, and issued a single called Bloody Revolutions that accused the socialist revolutionaries of the same false logic that had led to the Holocaust. As for the oi kind of skinhead bands that emerged in the late 70s, early 80s, and was often blamed for right-wing violence, their politics were primarily articulated in class terms. Indeed, the series of debates and conferences organised by some of the oi bands and Gary Bushell, again, in 1981, who by this time had left the SWP and was finding his own kind of overtly class-based socialism at odds with sections of the far left, defined OI as pro-working class, avowedly anti-Tory and committed to fighting police harassment and unemployment. Those present at these conferences he organised in early 1981 proposed to unite all working class kids in common cause and recognised that, quote, black and white kids have got more in common with each other than they have got against each other. Now, given such analysis, the far left was rejected more on class terms than anything else. This was most famously expressed in a song called Suburban Rebels by The Business, which dismissed the left as the middle class, quote, sons and daughters of well-off bankers, and you can guess what the second line rhymes with. That is, students who played at being revolutionaries whilst knowing little about the social inequalities of which they complained. Simultaneously, most oi bands wanted nothing to do with the far right. Some literally beat the fascist presence out of their audience. Others sought to accommodate fascist elements in an attempt to forge some kind of working class unity. So the Foreskins, Tom McCourt, who's bloke on the far left, in the bottom left there, Hoxton Tom, as he was known as, he said, "We are the politics of the street. We don't want any Zeke Heiling. If there is any, we always try and cut it out. Equally, we don't want any lefties waving their red books." Ultimately, however, such an approach began to unravel for these oi bands following the infamous gig at the Harborough Tavern in Southall in July 1981, which led to a riot in which the gig was attacked by local Asian youths wary of this large skinhead presence in the area. And the result was wide-scale media coverage portraying OI as a soundtrack of choice for Nazi skinheads. But as should be made clear, punk contained within it a diverse range of political impulses. Its emergence and subsequent development was very much entwined with the political and socio-economic context in which its protagonists and its audience came of age. It's a kind of formative political moment, I'd suggest. Punk reflected the world of which it was part, whilst also railing against it. Its impetus was one of negation, a critique of prevailing cultural, political and social mores. It asked questions and expressed both disillusionment and discontent. It did not really provide any answers other than do it yourself. As a result, attempts by both the left and the right to codify punk's politics, either in relation to a particular social issue or towards a specific ideology, could inform punk's development but prove difficult to sustain. So to define or align punk in some ways was to stifle it and thereby disarm the dialectic that had initially provided it with a resonance. So just to kind of tie all this together quickly. By the 1980s, the kind of enthusiasm that the far right and the far left had for punk had begun to diminish. The election of Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government paved the way for a major readjustment of British politics, breaking the so-called consensus for good under the hammer of monetarism and what Stuart Hall labelled authoritarian populism. One of the victims of this, arguably, was the National Front, whose forward march was blocked by the Conservatives' hardened rhetoric on immigration and law and order. But the left suffered too. Labour's practical socialism had already run into difficulties as it grappled with the economic problems of the late 1960s and 1970s. Labour's failure to manage the crisis, combined with the perceived limitations of its collectivist vision, helped forge the context in which punk emerged. In response, punk, Britain's revolutionary groups, battled, I would suggest, to these changing times, imagining themselves as the heir to the Labour Party, while simultaneously struggling to navigate the changing political landscape that was developing. Amidst all this, punk's legacy was picked over by the left and right, and it was usually found wanting. The punk graphics disappeared from the Young Communist newspapers. The SWP support for Rock Against Racism was wound down. And those arguing for the socialist worker that it had become too preoccupied with youth culture succeeded in refocusing its agenda in line with the changing priorities of the party. Even the advent of things like Two Tone and the riotous summer of 1981 was seemingly checked by the emergence of things like New Romanticism and New Pop, both of which the left tended to see as either frivolous or self-defeating. And the result, despite Rock Against Racism's claim to have contributed to the National Front's collapse, was a sense of disillusionment recorded in a series of articles over the early 1980s. While musicians who propagated a political message were still covered and coveted by the left, the notion that a musical style or youth culture could form the basis for a wider political mobilisation was seriously checked. On the far right, the failure to claim either punk or oi wholly for itself led eventually to a development of a distinctly racial musical movement around bands such as Screwdriver and Brutal Attack. Through Bulldog's Rock Against Communism chart, it continued to include songs by non-racist and anti-fascist bands into 1983-84, but the emphasis was increasingly placed on groups who emerged out of the ultra-nationalist movements that were formed by people already members of the National Front or whatever far-right group. At the same time, others on the far right reasserted their belief that popular music was degenerate, and as the NF splintered into warring factions, so its implosion was partly blamed on its attempt to appeal to youth culture. So in one exchange, the National Front rump was accused by Tyndall's New National Front of representing, quote, the gays, the punks and the racial Trotskyists. So punk then was initially understood by sections of the far left and the far right as an expression of youthful, primarily working-class revolt. In both cases, such a reading was instigated below the level of the party leadership. It was from within the kind of the youthful milieu of activists, suggesting a generational shift in the composition and perspective of Britain's revolutionary cadre. It reflected, too, a cultural turn in their respective politics. For the left, in particular, it was part of a significant move away from its traditional attachment to class and towards a more subjectivist or identity-based politics. For the left and right, it affirmed culture as a site of political struggle, with both accusing mainstream popular culture of diverting attention away from the real inequalities or inequities of society. Punk, it seemed, offered a challenge to this, using youth culture and music to open up a space through which to voice dissent or dissatisfaction. Where the left saw music as a medium for protest, a mouthpiece to propagate progressive ideas and register opposition, so the right applied a more spatial approach, seeking to claim ownership of the bands, the venues and localities in which youth culture was given expression. This in turn blurred into, but was more typically eclipsed by, less politically acute tensions based around subcultural allegiances, football rivalries, and the type of turf warfare that had long been characteristic of youth groups and local gangs. Ultimately, however, neither the right nor the left proved able to incorporate the concerns raised by punk into their own ideological framework. The difficulties of claiming popular music or youth culture as the basis of political movement are legion, and people like John Street and Simon Frith have written a lot about this. But with regard to punk, punk did provide an outlet for a form of protest, and it did bring political discourse into the mainstream of British culture. Some of it was even informed by existing political groupings. But this was done in a reflexive and not necessarily consistent fashion. Punk questioned, reported and rejected far more than it defined or directed. As a result, attempts to give punk a coherent ideological form, either from within or from without, proved contentious. For the far left and far right, the harnessing of youth culture to their respective causes may have brought brief return in terms of profile and influence amongst a certain milieu of young people, but it served also to cut across, fracture and undermine the socio-economic or racial certainties that had previously anchored their conceptions of socialism on the left and nationalism on the right. Rather than secure lasting support, such a focus helped reaffirm notions of individualism and cultural experimentation that lent themselves more to political fragmentation or disengagement than to activism mediated through traditional political forms, parties, elections, meetings. Punk's anger, far more often than not, was aimed at organisations, institutions and authority in general, and that included the self-appointed vanguards recruiting from the fringes of Britain's polity. Thank you.